Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in India and Oakland, California, and earned a BA in theology from Bethany College and an MA in religious studies from Wheaton College. For 12 years, he ran a church in Urbana, Illinois, and then was the president of Bethany College for 14 years. Since 1993, he's been a life coach with International Foundation. He's a collector of people, a connector, and a world-class storyteller, and the author of Known, Finding Deep Friendships in a Shallow World. His name, Dick Folt. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dick Folt, a collector of people, a connector, and a world-class storyteller. So buckle your seatbelts. You're going to hear some fabulous stories this evening. Dick, welcome. Real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. My joy.
Can we start by you offering an opening prayer this evening?
You bet. Lord, here we are again. Thank you for your grace. Thank you for Jack. Thank you for these listeners. Thank you for 2021. We are grateful for the start of a new cycle, a new year, and we pray the best for all who listen today as we begin this year together. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you. Dick, what if we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I was born 3 months after Pearl Harbor in Alameda, California, which is near Oakland across the bay from San Francisco. Born into a pastor's family. And when I was 3 and a half, my parents went to South India as missionary educators. So I spent my first few years in India at the tail end of the British colonial era. I remember standing on a street corner in the tea plantations up in the hills of South India with a little Indian flag in one hand, a little British flag in the other, watching the empire march out of India. And, you know, I was too small to realize what all was going on then. But looking back, it was a profound time. Came back home, lived in Missouri for a year, but brought up in California. And in the 50s in California, at least in Northern Cal where I grew up, it was kind of idyllic. It was an idyllic time. Ended up going to university my first year at Cal Berkeley and then transferred to a little college called Bethany and met my soon-to-be wife. And the rest, as they say, is history.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
I think the biggest thing I learned from my father was probably the power of language, the power of words. He himself was an articulate speaker. And so I think I got that from him and perhaps the sense of adventure. From my mother, I think the idea that you need to stick with things through thick and thin was a big deal. And that stick-to-itiveness, as we would say, was part of who she was.
Your mom saw the century mark. She lived to be 100.
She did. She beat it by 4 weeks, actually. She was born on July the 11th, 1910, when Taft was president and the annual income of an American was $945 a year. There were 1,000 miles of paved roads in the United States. You'll like this because of Detroit. And that year, Henry Ford built 10,000 cars, all black, you know, any color, as long as it's black. And but it was just an amazing thing. And so she lived all through when she was 7, of course, you had the great Spanish influenza epidemic. When she was 4, it would have been World War I, the stock market crash in 1929, the Great Depression. And so she was not, I tell people, she wasn't just a survivor. She was a victor in a lot of ways.
All right, from 1966 to 78, you practiced and were a salesman for God at Stone Creek Church, adjacent to the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois. Talk about that chapter of your life.
Well, Ruth and I had been married for 2 years. 3 weeks after our marriage in 63, I loaded up the, folks can appreciate this in Detroit as well, or in Michigan, I loaded up the 1960 Corvair, Chevy Corvair that I got in the deal, and we drove to Wheaton Graduate School, spent 2 years there. And then in 66, came back to do a church plant at the University of Illinois. You're going to stay a couple of years. I wanted to go back to India. As it turns out, we stayed 12 years. And it was back all during the Vietnam War, or the closing stages of, and all the upheaval of the civil unrest and all of that going on. And I was 24 years old. I was green as a gourd. And so I learned a tremendous amount from those years. And the folks in the congregation who loved us in spite of ourselves, and just came to grips with several things that have stayed with me all these years. And it was a profound time. That 12-year period might have been the greatest personal, emotional, spiritual growth spurt in my life.
When you had that Corvair living in Wheaton outside Chicago and you had a minus 10 degree morning, yes, how long did it take that heater to work in that Corvair?
you know this car. I got a job both Christmases working at the Chicago Post Office that used to span the Eisenhower Expressway. And I worked the graveyard shift, right? 11 to 7, I'd come out. That car would be dead as a doornail. I called AAA. After about the fourth day, I said, my name's Richard Foth. They say, we'll be right over. I mean, I can't, my tires might have been frozen to the pavement for all I know. It was quite the ride. It was fun.
All right. We're talking to Dick Foth. And from 1978 to 1992, he served as president of Bethany College, where he had gotten a BA in theology. When we come back, we're going to ask him, what does a college president do? And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Dick Foth, who from 78 to 92 served as president of Bethany College. Dick, what does a college president do?
The simple answer to that, historically, is that a college president is a person who lives in a big house and begs. I thought college presidency, especially in a small college, would be shaping students' lives and all that. But it's all about raising funds and trying to be an interpreter from faculty to trustees and vice versa, because the trustees hold the mission. The president articulates that vision over the next few years, and the faculty helps execute the vision. So it's a slow dance to make sure that probably not unlike Washington, D.C. in some ways.
Speaking of which, in 1993, you convinced Ruth, honey, we have to move to Washington, D.C. She said yes for a second time. Why did you do that?
When I left the college in 92, I was 50 years old, and I was tired. Looking back, I'd say I was burned out, but then I was too proud to say that, so I didn't say that. But we decided to take a self-imposed, self-funded sabbatical for a year, and we moved to the East Coast. And in that spring semester of 93, I was what they called minister in residence at a place called Gordon Conwell Seminary in Boston. And I had some friends who were connected with DC. They gave my name to somebody and they said, come down here and talk to us. And these folks in DC essentially work behind the scenes, one-on-one and in small groups, to encourage people in places of leadership to do the right thing and be the right kind of people. And so that's how we got to Washington, D.C. I'm not a political person. I vote. But we really sensed it was the right thing to do at that time in our lives.
And the man that convinced you to do that was the late, great Doug Coe.
That was he.
And one of the quotes that I'd learned from him was, "I'm called to simply be an ambassador of Jesus Christ's love." Yeah. And you guys did that to the world leaders. What was that like?
Well, you know, when I was a young church planter and a college president, you're sort of a Moses, right? Small pond, small M. You go to Washington, D.C., and that's not your role. There are lots of Moseses in Washington, D.C. My role, from a biblical perspective, was to be an Aaron, to be a brother, to hold up the hands of these other guys. And so you have to see yourself in a different way in order to do that. You're not lead dog, but you're a non-agenda-driven friend to be able to support and encourage them. And when you don't have an agenda for people, especially when those are people in places of power, where virtually anybody who knocks on their door wants something, when you don't want anything except to help them be better at who they are and what they do, it takes some time because they're waiting for the other shoe to drop. I mean, like if you say, "Senator, just want to be your friend," they say, "Yeah, sure. Everybody wants to be my friend." But if they wait a couple of years and the other shoe doesn't drop, then they say, "Well, let's have that conversation." So for me, it was a study in understanding what can happen apart from Madison Avenue techniques historically, in terms of, quote, marketing, sales, whatever you want to call it, that what can happen when you go deep with a few. When I spoke to Doug initially, I said, how do you get to know senators? You can't go around and leave your card. That's what lobbyists do. Those are folks who want stuff. I said, "How do you get to know five or six senators?" He said, "You don't need to. All you need to know is one. If you walk with one deeply over time, chances are you'll connect to other people, but that's not your goal. Your goal is to walk with the one." And that's counterintuitive to almost anything we know in business or otherwise.
As I listened to one of our mutual friends, Chuck McLeod, who's doing that today,
you bet,
that ministry, he will tell you that one of the loneliest lives today and the least trustful lives today are politicians. Why so?
I think, you know, I saw James Whitmore, I think that's his name, do a single act at the Ford Theater playing Will Rogers. And Will Rogers had this line: "I flew into town today, went past the Washington Monument. I liked flying past that because it seems like that's the only thing in Washington that has a point to it." And then he went on to say, "And we have the best politicians money can buy." I think people feel sometimes that political leaders can be bought. And today, more so, because it takes so much money to be elected. I mean, just this last election cycle, unbelievable, hundreds of millions of dollars spent. And I think people often go to, and I'll use Washington, D.C. as an example, with ideals that get eroded because of the pressures of party, special interests, over time, pretty quickly. I think there are a lot of people with good hearts in Washington, D.C., who get compromised over time by the circumstances and by the folks to whom they're beholden. And that's not so much a criticism as it is just an observation about life.
You met so many famous people in that 15-year chapter of your life in D.C. One was Attorney General John Ashcroft. Could you share with us a story about him, please?
Well, I lived for 1 year in Springfield, Missouri, when I was 8 years old. And I was three doors down from this kid named John David, who was 2 months older than he, and a year ahead of him in school. It's the only places I've ever been ahead of him. And we became friends, kept our friendship over the years. And 45 years later, we moved to D.C. And the next year, he had been governor of Missouri twice and attorney general twice. He was elected senator and came to D.C. And so John came, and I tell people, when we were 8 years old, we would ride our bikes, be Marco Polos in Springfield, Missouri, catch tadpoles and watch them grow into frogs. And so we did that same thing in Washington, D.C. But one of my favorite stories, and I think this is the one you might be referring to, is when he was a attorney general, of course, you're guarded by the FBI. And so the FBI would always come with two battle wagons. If they came to our house, you'd have two armored Chevy Blazers, four FBI agents, and they'd sit out on our driveway, pointed out toward the street, ready to go if there was a problem. And John would come in. And oftentimes my wife, Ruth, who's a wonderful baker, would bake apple pie and things. And she'd say, take some out to the guys. And I don't know if this is the story you're talking about, but it's a, and so I take some out to the guys. And one day John said, both, you've got to stop doing that. Those fellas, they're paid to do that. And it's okay. And I said, yeah, but Ruth, not satisfied. She wants them to be fed. She's a mom and a wife and so forth. And so there was a season, there was at one point at which he got very, very ill. And I ended up in California and saw on the CNN screen or whatever program it was that the attorney general had pancreatitis that was very severe, almost fatal. And anyway, long story short, he went sort of dark for about 10 days. And so I called his secretary and said, I'm going to go over and put a card in John's mailbox. He lived a couple of blocks behind the Supreme Court. And I said, so call the FBI because they have an apartment across the street and all that. And they got the guns. And so tell them not to shoot me. Well, she forgot to say that. And as I started up the stairs, a uniformed officer came running over and said, sir, come back down here. And so I came back down. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm putting a card. The attorney general's, he's a friend of mine. And he said, just hold it right there. And he gets on the walkie-talkie. He calls the FBI guys across the street. And I hear the voice on the other side say, is that Mr. Foth? And the guy said, like, are you Mr. Foth? I said, yes, I am. And I said, all I want to do is put this card in the attorney general's mail slot. And he conveyed that to the FBI agent. He just wants to put a card. And I hear the voice on the other side saying, Mr. Foth may do anything he pleases. And I said, yes. And it was so apple pie makes things work in the world. Just saying.
And someday maybe Ruth will tell you, Mr. Foth, you can do anything you please. Anything is possible. We're talking to Dick Foth. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasul, and we're with Dick Foth. If you want to learn more, www.known.fm. I quote you now, all great leaders have certain things in common: humility, authenticity, kindness, and vulnerability. Are you sure about the fourth one, vulnerability, Dick?
I'm sure about it. I'm not always sure world leaders are sure about it. You know, vulnerability, of course, is dangerous because it can be used as a weapon. I share something about myself that's a struggle, and you turn around and use it as a knife to slide in under my fifth rib. And, of course, that's always the challenge. But I think the vulnerability is essentially truth-telling about yourself. And you have to be careful what you say. I mean, you know, Jimmy Carter was vulnerable in an article, and they just lampooned him from then on, and other kinds of people. But it was it's interesting because recently I had the great privilege of interviewing former President George W. Bush. And by privilege, I mean anytime you have a chance to speak to someone who has had responsibilities at that level, no matter what the party or what the background, I see that as an honor. And in his book, Decision Points, which was written a couple of years after his presidency, he talked about all the things that he gets criticized for, the Iraq thing and so forth. And what was profound to me was that he owned it, if you will. And I'm not talking just about from a political perspective. He starts out talking about the fact that he had a tremendous drinking problem and it was consuming his life. And when you're vulnerable, when you talk about, and by vulnerability, I think I'm talking about suffering in part. When you talk about suffering, way more people will connect to that than they will to your achievements or your victories. And so I see vulnerabilities in that context, in that lens, through that lens.
Speaking of people being connected, since 1953, the first Thursday in February in Washington, D.C., we've had the National Prayer Breakfast. Mm-hmm. And you and Doug Coe, I think you went there 26 years.
Right.
The 3,000 people from all over the world, always a keynote speaker. Were there one or two speakers that you said, wow?
The very first one when I was there was unusual because this person had a religious bent in the sense that they were mission-oriented. That was Mother Teresa. Most of the speakers were business folks or political folks. And she was the first speaker I heard. And she was so short in stature that they had to put a box for her to stand on. And you still had trouble seeing her face past the microphone. And she was straightforward. She, at certain points, was even humorous. Perhaps the best talk I've ever heard, and folks could Google this, I think it was the 2011 National Prayer Breakfast, and the speaker was Randall Wallace, who is a screenwriter from Hollywood, and he wrote the screenplays for Secretariat, We Were Soldiers, and Braveheart, which was the story of one of his ancestors, William Wallace. And his capacity to tell story, to use one verse, and weave the stories together with a pathos and with humor and with such focus was just, I watch it at least once a year, maybe more than that, because it was so profound and powerful to me.
Speaking of a world-class story, I believe that we have to be God's arms and legs. That's how God works.
Mm-hmm.
And I've asked Dick if he would share with us one phenomenal story about World War II in these times of uncertainty that we have today.
Not far from here, just east, a number of miles, is the town of North Platte, Nebraska. Anybody know North Platte, Nebraska? You've been there. North Platte's out there. It's, you know, you got to want to go to North Platte. In 1941, it was a town of 12,000 people. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 12,000 people at this Union Pacific Railroad hub called North Platte. 10 days later, there was a train coming through with National Guard troops. The word went out it was Nebraska National Guard troops, and so some folks baked cookies and stuff and went down to the train. And they went down to give them some cookies, but they looked in the windows and it wasn't Nebraska guys. They couldn't find any of their own. It turned out to be Kansas. But they stood there, you know, with the cookies and the cakes and stuff. And finally, one young woman by the name of Ray Wilson, a drugstore clerk, said, "Well, I'm not keeping my cookies. I'm not taking my cookies home." She stepped up and gave them to one of the young men, and then everybody gave their stuff. Immediately after that, when they started moving army troops through and sailors and stuff, Ray Wilson organized some women. And they decided they were going to meet the trains that came through North Platte, Nebraska. Bob Green, a journalist from Chicago Tribune, has written about this in a book called Once Upon a Time. And they started to meet the trains. And over the next 4.5 years, they organized, mostly women, 55,000 women. And they met every train that came in, sometimes up to 32 trains a day. And the Union Pacific Railway gave the restaurant to them, and they dubbed it the North Platte Canteen. And they got 10 minutes to get off the train. These guys would jump off the train, run in there, and there would be wall-to-wall tables with sandwiches and cakes and pies. One woman said, "My job during the war was to make 10 angel food cakes from scratch with turkey eggs every week in the back of that train station." Everything was rationed. People had to give it out of their own goods. Only $5 came from the government, and it was a check from Franklin Roosevelt. Said, "I heard you're doing some good things out there," and he sent $5. The people of these towns like yours, all over that area, came there during the course of the war. I mean, these guys would jump out of the train, run in there, and there'd be hot coffee, there'd be donuts, there'd be pheasant sandwiches in season. And I said this at the Nebraska Governor's Prayer Breakfast, and the senator came to me afterwards and said, "Sometimes pheasant sandwiches out of season." And They'd get back on the train and they'd go off, many never to return. During the course of the war, 6 million United States servicemen and women came through North Platte, Nebraska, and every single train was met. And the story would go something like this. A guy would say, I graduated from Brooklyn High School, never been out of New York City. Went down and signed up on Monday. They put me on a train going west. I rode for 3 days and nights, sitting up, eating K rations, not taking a shower. And somebody in the middle of the night said, North Platte, Nebraska, next stop. Never heard of North Platte, Nebraska. Jumped off the train, ran into a place, and I saw girls who looked like my sisters and my cousins, and women who looked like my aunts and my mom. And they had all this food, and they gave it to us. And when we left, they hugged us, and they said, Sailor, we're praying for you. God bless you. And we get back on the train, scared out of our minds, not knowing where we were going, not knowing if we'd ever come back. But when we went into that place for 10 minutes, something went away. We got back on the train, and we went on. And in the middle of the night in France, with mortars coming down, when there was a lull in the fighting, a voice would come out of the darkness saying, wouldn't it be great to be back in North Platte for 5 minutes? Because love chases away fear. And when Bob Green interviewed these guys, they'd start crying. 85-year-old guys start crying. He said, what are you crying for? He said, because here I was, an 18-year-old kid, scared to death. And I went into that place. And for 5 minutes in the middle of the night, in a place I'd never been to with people I'd never met, going to a place I didn't know, somebody loved me and was kind to me. I told this story in Denver a couple years ago at the 60th anniversary of Youth for Christ Campus Life. The young woman came up to me the next morning and said, when you were telling that story, I thought about my grandpa. My grandpa was in the Navy, and he lived in Pennsylvania, and I wondered, did he go through North Platte, Nebraska? She said, my grandpa's 90 years old in a nursing home, and he has dementia. He doesn't remember us most of the time. But I called him, and I said, Grandpa, this is Jennifer. And I said, Grandpa, does the name North Platte, Nebraska mean anything to you? And he said, North Platte, Nebraska. Instantly, he was lucid. You bet it does. He said, I went in there and they gave me donuts and sandwiches and coffee. And they shined my shoes. You bet I remember North Platte, Nebraska. What is it, 60 years after the fact, that brings a 90-year-old man out of dementia? When you're scared and you're 18 and you're going off to war and on the way, somebody loves you and is kind to you.
That was Dick Vogt sharing us a world-class story. And I'm Jack Wasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Wasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoholm.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Wasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Dick Vogt. If you want to learn more, www.known.fm. Dick, you truly love Jesus. What's that like?
Well, when I was 7 years old, my parents were missionary educators in South India, and I was in this British boarding school, and they had little chapel services once in a while. And at the end of one of those, the person who was talking said, if you want to know more about this Jesus, at the end of this chapel, go to the principal's office. Well, the principal's office is a huge hurdle to the kingdom of God. But I went anyway and gave as much as I understood of my seven-year-old self to as much as I could understand of Jesus. And over the years, as I've read him first of all, he's the most fascinating person I think one could ever read or follow. There are more books in the Library of Congress about Jesus of Nazareth than anybody else. I think Abraham Lincoln and Napoleon are distant seconds and thirds. But there's a quote from Dorothy Sayers, British mystery writer from the last century, that captures me when it says, "To do them justice, the people who crucified the Christ did not do so because he was a bore. Quite the contrary, he was too dynamic to be safe. It has been left for later generations to muffle up that shattering personality and surround him with an atmosphere of tedium." And my experience with following Jesus is I just keep saying, God, don't let me muffle up his shattering personality. Here's a person who asks you questions like, "What will it profit you, Foth, if you gain the whole world and lose your own soul?" Like, that's a pretty good question. And just the stories about living and life and relationships, there is no one I have read, no one I have heard in the best sense of that word, that comes anywhere close to Jesus of Nazareth.
We're talking to Dick Foth. He's a collector of people, a connector, and a world-class storyteller. Okay, I listened to you a few weeks ago, and you used a quote from Corey Ten Boom. Quote, "You don't know Jesus is all you need till Jesus is all you have."
You know, I think Corey Ten Boom's story is so profound. She and her watchmaker father had a little shop in Harlem outside of Amsterdam in the Second World War, and they ended up hiding Jews. They were caught. The father, her sister, and she went to the camps. The father and the sister died, and she was let out of the camp she was in because of a, quote, clerical error. But here was a woman who had gone through all of these things, and she weathered, she survived, she was a victor in all of these things, in no small part, primarily because of her trust in Jesus. She would say that. What is profound to me, you talked about my mom dying a few weeks after 100. My mother is buried in Santa Ana Cemetery in Santa Ana, California. And much of Corey Ten Boom's later years were lived in Southern California. And when we had her service there, had my mom's service, I was wandering around to the other graves, and maybe 30 feet from where my mother is buried, Corey Ten Boom is buried. And one of her quotes that I love is, "There is no pit so deep that the love of God is not deeper still."
Another quote from you: "The difference between pushing my agenda or just living my life determines whether a listener feels like a target or a friend." Guilty as charged. When I've got something I want to convince you of, okay, I'm going to convince you. I'm going to slam it down your throat.
Right.
How do I learn not to do that?
You know, I that idea came to me from Dr. Richard Halverson, who was chaplain of the Senate in 1993, United States Senate. And I sat with him and asked him how he worked with senators. And he told me the backstory that I won't take the time to tell, but he just said, "I made a determination when I came to this office that I would meet a senator anywhere, anytime, under any circumstance, at his or her convenience, with no agenda except theirs." And I said, "But you've got an agenda. You want that person to follow Jesus?" And he said, "No, Dick, that's not my agenda. That's my life." And this idea that I have to convince you and win you, persuade you, make sure we close the deal. There are parts of that that are valid and valuable, but the fact is that I am not responsible for outcomes. I'm only responsible for inputs. So if I can be your friend, if I can follow Jesus, and because we're friends, in some way you might follow him too, even if you don't fully understand. That's how that works. But you have to work hard, from my experience, not to have an agenda that frames the conversation. If the agenda is theirs, then you might get invited into their journey. And that took me a decade to really grapple with and learn. And I was in my late 50s and early 60s when that happened.
In 2017, you and Ruth wrote a book, Known, Finding Deep Friendships in a Shallow World. What do you want us to take from that book, please?
That we live in a world of unbelievable connections. The young people today, 20, 30 and under, are the first generations that have not had to go to an authority figure for information. All they do is look at their phones and then go around the world, find all of these challenges. But they are overwhelmed by the number of connections, by the shallowness of the connections. They're not deep friendships generally that come that way. And the takeaway from the book is if you want to have a friendship, you have to pursue it in particular ways. And there are four essential points to that, if we have a moment for it. If I see on the screen behind you as we're doing this call, Wrigley Field, baseball is perfect. First base in any relationship is your story. Where are you from? What's shaped you? Who are the people who left their fingerprints on your soul? When you tell me your story, first base, I start knowing how to love you, how to respond. Second base is affirmation. Hey, this is why I like you. These are the ways that I can like you. Third base is covenant. As we start hanging together, we do stuff together. You know, and if it's ladies, oftentimes it's coffee clutches or sitting face to face. For guys, I think it's more side to side. We go hiking or bowling or fishing or something. And so covenants come into play as third base, and home plate is dreaming. That's, if I can trust you with my past, maybe I can trust you with my dreams. So that's the takeaway.
Dick Foth, you are a world-class storyteller, but more importantly, you're a world-class ambassador for God. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you, Jack. God bless you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.